Part 7. Some of our best friends are drug dealers. Chapter 1. Mick. In which the former Bob Allen Deal recounts the hijinks of his youth eons ago when cowboys roamed the land and birth control had clearly not yet been invented. Back in my day, bailing rope wasn't made out of wire. It was real rope, about a quarter inch wide if you laid it out flat. It was closer to twine, really, and we used it to bale the hay. I guess we also used it to hang my older brother. My younger brother, Tim, and I made a 1.5-foot loop in the bailing rope and held it together with a slip knot. I threw the loop over the branch of an oak tree and tied the other end of the rope around the trunk. Tim found a 5-gallon drum in my grandmother's shed and placed it under the hanging noose. Then we made our older brother, Frank, stand on the drum, slipped the noose around his neck, and made sure it was good and tight. I kicked the drum out from under him, and we watched him swing. We were the Indians. He was the cowboy. He screamed and struggled as he dangled in the air, and he kept grabbing at the noose with his hands, trying to loosen it. When we grew bored of running around him, whooping and hollering, Tim and I headed inside. "Where's Frank?" Aunt Thelma asked. Aunt Thelma, who couldn't have been more than 5 feet tall, was my grandmother's most loyal daughter and lived with her until finally marrying at the age of 55. "Out there," Tim pointed to the side yard. "Oh, my word," Aunt Thelma gasped, and she ran out to the tree, lifted Frank up, and pulled the noose off his neck. I was 5 years old, and I wasn't messing around. I was born B.A.D. Bob Allen Deal. People who have had near-death experiences always say they enter a tunnel, and at the end of the tunnel, there is a light. I like to think that when you die, you go through the tunnel, and when you get to the other end, you are reborn. The tunnel is the birth canal, and the light at the end of the tunnel is the hospital maternity ward, where your new life awaits you. When someone has a near-death experience where they see the light but don't walk into it, there is a woman somewhere delivering a stillborn baby who is supposed to have that person's soul. I used to tell people that in a past life I was Buddy Holly. Then I came back as Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, and finally I returned to Earth as Mick Mars. But I was never serious. That doesn't mean I've ruled out the possibility of a past life, but I do wonder why people always believe they were a famous or historical figure. What happened to the chimney sweeps and beggars and housewives? Didn't they get reincarnated too? As for me, I was informed of my past lives by a wise old hippie burnout known as the Midnight Gardener, who used to come to my house in the Santa Monica Mountains and tend to my lawn every night at 1 a.m. The Midnight Gardener told me that I had been the king of Borneo, a cannibal, and a slave who worked on the Great Pyramids of Egypt. I think I must have been some sort of womanizer and thief because in this life, I'm being punished for it. Women and money don't like me. In fact, the former always seemed to walk out of my life with all the latter. From the time I hanged my brother, I knew what I wanted to do with this life. Because later that week, Aunt Thelma took Frank, Tim, and me to the 4-H Fair in Hyers Park in Huntington, Indiana, where we lived. She bought us popsicles, and we sat down in the grass to eat them and watch a concert. I was so young, I didn't even know what a concert was. I saw a tall, skinny guy in a bright orange rhinestone cowboy suit and a white hat, much fancier than the cowboy outfit Frank had worn when I lynched him. The man on the stage introduced himself as Skeeter Bond, and he started singing. There were other cowboys playing guitar and drums behind him, making a lot of noise. My jaw dropped open, and I completely forgot about my popsicle, which melted all over my clothes. I wanted to be him. I wanted to make music on a stage. I didn't care what kind of music, really. Music was music. It was all great, whether it was Skeeter Bond, cowboy music, or my mom's Elvis Presley records. That Christmas, my brothers and I ran downstairs in the morning to open our presents. There were long stockings hanging over the fireplace, and one of them had a tiny guitar strung with what were probably rubber bands. "That's mine," I yelled, and I grabbed it before anyone could take it from me. The following Christmas, when I was 6, my mother bought me a Mickey Mouse guitar, which had mouse ears on the head and a little crank that I could turn to make it play Mouseketeer songs. But I wasn't interested in Mouseketeer songs. I learned how to tighten the strings so that it sounded more like Skeeter Bond's twangy guitar, and figured out how to play actual melodies on it. There was a cool loafer in his 20s who lived nearby, and I called him Sundance. He had an old guitar named Blue Moon, and he taught me my first real song on Blue Moon. "My dog has fleas." Sometimes I wonder whether country music was my real calling. Eventually, Sundance taught me how to pick melodies, like the murder ballad, "Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley." I liked the melodies because they jumped out of Blue Moon, and though I didn't know the terminology at the time, I was already favoring lead guitar over rhythm, which seemed more like something that was played in the background. If it wasn't for Jesus being born, I never would have gotten anywhere in music, because it was on another Christmas a few years later that my oldest cousin bought me a Stella guitar that he had found in a pawn shop for $12. Soon afterward, my parents gave birth to their first girl, Susan, or Bird, as we called her. Bird was born with a collapsed lung, and in order to increase her chance of survival, her doctors suggested that we move to a more arid climate like Arizona or California. So 10 of us, me, my brothers, my parents, my sister, my aunt, my uncle, and my cousins, crunched into a 1959 Ford. After 3.5 days of stiff backs and oxygen deprivation, we arrived in Garden Grove, California. It was like the Grapes of Wrath, only California actually lived up to the fantasy. There were orange trees everywhere, and at night, we could see the fireworks going off above Disneyland. But in California, country music and Skeeter Bond were foreign words. Surf music was what was happening. Dick Dale, The Ventures, The Surfaris. My father worked at Menasha Container, which made cardboard boxes for one of my favorite companies, Fender, and my mother ironed shirts on weekends for extra money. $2 a day if she was lucky. Though I had another younger brother and a sister by then, she still saved up enough to buy me a $49 St. George electric guitar. Now I could make surf music that sounded like curling and crashing waves, just like Dick Dale played it. Volume was also important to me, but my parents didn't have enough money to buy me an amplifier or a stereo. Instead, I took my little sister's phonograph speaker, removed the wires from the tone arm, and made my own combination amp and stereo so that I could play along with my favorite surf songs. My father, in the meantime, woke up one day and suddenly decided to become a Baptist minister. When he was a child, he had suffered from a crippling disease that attacked his legs. The doctors said there was nothing they could do for him except pray for mercy from God. When the disease cleared up, it must have planted a God trigger in my dad's mind, which fired that morning when he came running into the kitchen raving that he had seen the error of his ways and wanted to dedicate his life to a ministry. Despite finding religion, my father never tried to discourage me from making music. He and my mother thought that the reason I was so obsessed was that my brain had been fried when I was 3. I came down with scarlet fever and ran a 106-degree temperature for 3 days. A doctor came to my grandmother's house, where I was in bed almost dead, and took off all my clothes, covered me with cold towels, and packed my bed with ice. Then he opened up every door and window in the house until the winter air filled the room, and after an hour, the fever broke. I was so sick, they said, that maybe I never recovered. Surf music to them was just another disease. But soon after came an even more infectious disease, the Beatles. Overnight, surf rock was archaic and pop with vocals, melodies, harmonies, and lyrics you could nod your head to was in. I decided that I had to sing, too. I practiced every day for a year until I was ready to show my family. I gathered them downstairs and sang Money by the Beatles. The cousin who had bought me my first real guitar went into a fit of hysterics. He said I wouldn't be able to carry a tune if he wrapped it up and put handles on it. I was so embarrassed that I never tried to sing again for the rest of my life. At 14, I joined my first band, the Jades, a Beatles cover group with a few originals that might as well have been Beatles songs. I started off on bass, but soon replaced their guitarist. Our first gig was at the American Legion Hall in Westminster, and we made $12 to split between the four of us. We were never asked back, however. Either we were too heavy or too terrible. I had a friend named Joe Abbey, a Samoan who had never given up on surf guitar and could play so well he'd bring you to your knees. I wanted to borrow his amp and reverb pedal, but he said they belonged to the Garcia brothers. He gave me their phone number, and that's where it really began. I walked into their house and found three of them, Tony, Johnny, and Paulie. They were big and mean and led a street gang called the Garcia brothers. Tony was a guitar player who would have his brothers beat up anyone who said they were better than him. Paulie was a tall drummer who was unhappy because he felt like he should be playing guitar. And Johnny was a bass player who had been put in youth authority when he was 16 for beating up two cops. They also played with a non-brother, Paul, a blind harmonica player who looked like Jesus. They were tough, and they didn't play surf rock or the Beatles. They played the blues, hard, electric blues. Their neighbors hated them because they knew the brothers were doing drugs and fighting. For some reason, there were always blind, deaf, or handicapped people hanging around the brothers, and I figured it was evidence that they either had a soft, compassionate side or were running some kind of mysterious scam. At 9 p.m. one night, the cops arrested us all because of noise complaints, and I received what they called summer probation, basically just for playing my guitar. That may be why I now have a pet peeve against neighbors who make noise complaints. We formed a band, pretentiously, called Sounds of Soul, and played at underage clubs around Orange County, like the Sandbox. At school, I didn't care about anything except for music. I was one of the three best guitarists there. The best was Chuck Frayer, who could solo like nobody I'd seen before, bending notes and letting them hang in the air forever. He ended up getting drafted into the Marines during Vietnam, and the last time I saw him was on The Gong Show. He was playing the harmonica in a suit that made it look like he had two heads. And you can bet your mother's horse race winnings that he got gonged. The other great guitarist was Larry Hansen, who ended up with the Gatlin brothers. And the third was me. School was pure torture, and all I could think about was getting home to practice. In English, our teacher, Mr. Hickok, wanted us to write an essay on a poem. All the other kids wrote about Robert Frost and Ralph Waldo Emerson, but I came in with Pressed Rat and Warthog by Cream. When Mr. Hickok returned the papers, he had written on mine, F, which is a big understatement. The next day, we had a test, and I answered one question by calling the teacher a square music-hating snob, writing, which is a big understatement, beneath it. I handed in the paper, and when he read it, he sent me to the principal, who suspended me, which was a big understatement, he said, because I should have been expelled. I didn't care. I only wanted to be taught by people who knew something about music. But now I wish I had paid more attention in English classes, because when I talk to people, I worry that I sound uneducated or use the wrong words. When I returned to school, a substitute teacher in my science class kicked me out for writing guitar chord charts in my notebook instead of paying attention. As I walked out of the classroom, I turned back to him and yelled, "I know where you park your car. I know where you live. You better watch your back." I didn't think I was that intimidating a guy. I looked like a red-haired Dwayne Allman with a peach fuzz mustache. But the teacher got so freaked out, he sent the cops to my home. By then, I was living in a little garden shed behind my parents' house, which sat alongside a creek. It was a place where I could play my guitar at any hour, stay up as late as I wanted, and let friends crash and drink some vino. When the cops saw the place, they said it wasn't fit for a dog to live in. They lectured my parents, and though I was allowed to return to school, I guess I just stopped going after that. If school back then was like the ones they have today, with art classes, music appreciation, and computers, I would have stayed. But there was nothing there that interested me back then. I never paid much attention to girls. I met my first love at the Garcia brothers' house. She was 14, and some of the younger Garcia brothers, there had to have been at least a dozen Garcia brothers running around, brought her home from junior high. We started hanging out, and I figured that we were dating after a while. One night, I asked her to go out, and she said her parents were making her stay home with them. So I went bowling with Joe Abbey instead, and she walked into the bowling alley with another boy. I was devastated. I asked her what she was doing out, and she slurred something because she was drunk. As I felt my testosterone flow into my heart, making my blood burn, my friends dragged me out of the bowling alley and drove me off in their car. I gave up on women that day. All thoughts of girls, dating, and getting laid went down the chute, allowing me to spend even more time practicing. For Christmas that year, my Aunt Annie, who always believed in me, even when friends and family didn't, had bought me a beat-to-shit Les Paul for $98. Then in May, a kid gave me a 1954 Stratocaster when he graduated because he never played it. By that time, I was no longer one of the three best guitarists in my age range. I was the best. I soon stopped playing with the Garcia brothers. It had gotten too scary. Gang activities kept overlapping with band activities, and rival gangs were always coming over to start fights. One of the Garcia brothers later landed in jail after accidentally killing a little girl in a drive-by shooting, and another ended up playing in Richard Marx's band. I told you they were bad. The brothers used to work with a singer named Antone, who was probably one of the greatest black belters I'd ever heard. He tipped me off to a blues band in Fresno he was working with that needed a guitarist. So I packed up my two guitars, borrowed a reverb box from a friend, and they picked me up and brought me to Fresno. It was exciting at first because they were an all-black band and they wanted me to teach them about rhythm and soul. I sat down with them all day and showed them everything I knew, and at night I slept on a pool table in their clubhouse. But they became frustrated when they didn't sound like John Lee Hooker after a week, though I kept telling them that keeping cool and relaxed and patient is part of where soul comes from. As I was teaching them a blues scale on the porch, an old black guy drove up in a 1960 Cadillac with a ratty acoustic guitar in the seat. He was so big that his arms practically dragged on the ground when he opened the door and walked out. "That's the blues," I told the guys in the band. "You are living the blues." But they just couldn't play it, no matter how badly they wanted to. I was so let down, and I felt too old to be wasting my time like this. I guess I always felt like I was too old, even at 17. I had gone to Fresno with no cash, assuming that we'd soon be making money from our gigs. But there were no gigs, and I was broke. So I borrowed $10 from the drummer for food. After a few days, all I was hearing was, "You owe me $10. They were getting lessons for free, and all they could think about was money and greed. I picked watermelons in my spare time to earn extra change for food, but I didn't make enough to repay my debt, so the band ended before it even began. They drove me home, only so that they could hit up my Aunt Thelma for $10 when she answered the door. Greed is usually the greatest obstacle to success, right after selfishness. I was later able to repay Aunt Thelma, who went on to become Motley Crue's biggest fan. She saved every news clipping, subscribed to every metal magazine, and, despite being partially deaf, went to every concert she could. When her husband died, however, she disappeared. I eventually found her living in a house with no heat, no plumbing, no carpet, peeling paint, and a collapsed roof. I sent her money to fix up the place, and every time I saw her afterward, I'd slip her a few hundred for gas and water bills. She would always tell me that she couldn't understand how anybody could have as much money as I had given her. Like my father, she never lost some of the innocence of childhood. When I returned home after Fresno, my friend Ron was living in the shed behind my parents' house. I really had it rigged up by then. I had a black light, which shone on red and green psychedelic posters on the walls. I had a TV, which I had found discarded on a street corner, and I still used the homemade stereo I had made so long ago out of my sister's phonograph. Ron and I loved crosstops, which were basically trucker speed that you could buy in packs of 100 for 10 bucks at any pharmacy. We'd swallow fistfuls and hitchhike as far away as we could get, then return home from Whittier or wherever we were when the speed wore off at dawn. After speed, I started getting into Seconal, which was a heavy painkiller that I'd washed down with slow gin. I got so strung out that my doctor told me I'd die if I didn't quit. So I stopped cold, which was the stupidest thing I could do because going cold turkey on painkillers like that could have put me into a coma. When you get older, you worry about death and your own mortality a lot more than when you're younger. However, with cloning, which I'm sure has already been done with humans in secret, we're just one step away from scientific resurrection for the chosen ones. That is, the rich. I never really got into psychedelics. While I was hitchhiking, someone I met offered me a tab of mescaline. I took about half the tablet, which was the size of a Rolaide. When nothing happened, I took the other half. And then it hit me like a billy club. I was fucked up for 3 days. I was seeing people shrink and walk through walls and float into the air, and nothing made sense. All I could think was, when am I going to come down? I tried some orange microdot acid once, and the same thing happened. I was running so wild and getting so many dirty looks from my family that I figured it was time to find my own place. I didn't have any money, so I moved in with some bikers in Orange County. It was like being with the Garcia brothers again because I was far too scrawny and innocent. When they spilled beer on the floor, they'd pick me up and use my long hair as a mop. They didn't want to get their Levi's dirty, they'd explain. And I wouldn't argue. They all packed guns because other bike clubs would steal their motorcycles, file down the numbers, and keep or sell them. Nowadays, I have a good radar for trouble. I've been through it. When I see it coming, I duck because I know what happens when it hits you. But back then, my trouble radar wasn't in operation. So I didn't duck when a friend of mine named Mike Collins brought his ex-girlfriend, Sharon, to a party we were having. She was an earthy 5'2" brunette with auburn coloring in her hair and a face like Ally McGraw. We started dating right away, but she was much more serious than me. Her mother and father had broken up when she was young, and even though she was only 16, she craved the security that she had lacked in her childhood. Though she was after marriage from day one, I knew that I couldn't be a husband. I wanted to be a guitarist, and that was it. I was only 19 and had no plans of getting a job or settling down in any way whatsoever. I knew it would take a while to make it in rock and roll, and I was prepared to put in the time. Nonetheless, she came home from work one evening and with a vague smile on her face broke the news to me. I'm pregnant. No, I told her. I'm not stopping. This is what I want to do. She said she was keeping the baby and she found me a job at the laundromat where she worked at the time. I was playing after hours clubs with a band called Watoshi, which we thought meant number one in Chinese. We'd play until 6 a.m., then I'd sleep for 2 hours, go to the laundromat at 8 a.m., and work until it was time to play music again. A few months after my son, Les Paul, guess who named him, was born, Sharon was pregnant again. My dream couldn't have seemed any further away. I was stuck in everything I had spent my whole life trying to avoid. A wife, 2 kids, a regular guy job at a ridiculous laundromat. All this responsibility was coming down on me when I wasn't ready for it, and I couldn't bear the weight. I started having horrendous hot flashes. All of a sudden, my body would grow feverish, and I'd slip into another world that looked and felt a lot like hell. Other times, I'd black out for hours at a time. I'd wake up in bed or on stage or in the street and have no idea how I got there. I was going through some sort of transformation. Either I was going insane, or I was in some sort of strange mental cocoon that was part of the process of changing from a boy to a man. I didn't know which way to turn. I couldn't abandon my wife when she was pregnant, and I sure as heck wasn't going to give up on becoming a great blues or rock and roll guitarist. so I turned to the only person who I thought could help, God. I began talking with him, praying, asking for mercy and help and guidance. I may not know how we got here. We may be rejects from alien societies, or we may just be some master race's experiment in a petri dish called the world, but someone or something started this whole thing in motion. And at that time, I had to believe it was God. Because if I couldn't believe in God, I couldn't believe in anything. And if I couldn't believe in anything, what was the point in going on with my life? In the midst of this, a friend of my father's happened to stop by. He was an older deacon who had grown a beard to appear sophisticated, though it only served to make him look even older. The only thing worse is beards on bald men, because they make them look like they have their hair on upside down. The deacon quickly perceived that I was on the verge of a serious nervous breakdown. Do you want to get baptized? He asked, rubbing his old gray beard. I told him that yes, I did. He brought me to his church and stood me in 3 feet of water. I baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, he recited as he held my nose and dunked me backward into the water. I hope this helps, I thought to myself, as I emerged baptized. Nowadays, I don't believe in the Christian concept of a God who created people for the sole purpose of judging and punishing them. After all, if one of the commandments is, thou shalt not kill, does that make God a hypocrite when he does things like flooding the world or destroying Sodom and Gomorrah? But at the time, I needed the forgiveness. I needed someone to wash away my past and start me over again, fresh. It worked for a little while. I even formed a gospel band. But it was only a temporary relief, like Seconal. It killed the pain for a little while, but the pain came back with a new intensity. Every time I walked into church, I had a sick feeling inside that it wasn't where I was supposed to be, that maybe I was just even more trapped by normality. Now I had a wife, 2 children, a shitty job, and on top of it all, weekly services and church events to attend. One afternoon, I was working at the laundromat, exhausted from lack of sleep, transferring a 600-pound tub of wet clothes from the washer to the dryer. The tub was attached to a hook that hung from a conveyor belt on the ceiling, kind of like in a meat processing plant. And as I swung the tub toward the dryer, I lost my grip, and it swung back and smashed my left hand. A flash of panic shot through my head. What if I could never play guitar again? I walked into the main office, had it bandaged, and left for the day. I never returned, and though my hand eventually healed, Watoshi replaced me during my absence. I told Sharon that I'd never work a day job again, and she turned so many different colors of anger and sickness and disgust that she looked like some kind of TV test pattern. She had gotten me a job at the laundromat, and now I was throwing it away. She was sick of playing mother and father at the same time, and it was clear that I was unable to do anything for myself. So, on Christmas, the day when everything seems to happen in my life, she took Les Paul and our 5-month-old daughter, Stormy, a girl who would make me a grandfather 3 times over before I hit 40, and left me. Now, on top of everything else, I had to make child support payments, $200 a month. And I wasn't making a penny with music. Broke and in debt, I begged my parents to let me move back into their house. They did, and there I was, right back in the shed where I had started. I had taken a long time to go nowhere. On top of everything, the cops came knocking on my shed again, just like in high school. But this time, they took me to jail for non-payment of child support. And I spent 2 nights trying to keep guys from fucking me in the ass and lighting my bunk on fire. Then, just when I thought I couldn't sink any lower, came the news that would knock me into a pit of hell for the rest of my life.